Thank you very much, and particular thanks to Anthang for inviting me here to this really interesting seminar. My presentation today is on an aspect of the historical interactions between India and China that generally has not received much attention. And I propose to speak about the traces of Chinese art that can be found in India, which had their origin in the 19th century China trade between India and China. As we are all well aware, borrowing and adaptation have been an intrinsic part of the long interaction between India and China over the centuries. However, in the discourse on cultural transmission between India and China, it is often made out that this process was largely one way from India to China. This is mainly, though not entirely, due to the profound impact of Buddhism on China and Chinese culture, which we have talked a lot about this morning. What we find in the 19th century, however, is the transmission of cultural products and cultural influences from China to India, not nearly on the same scale as the earlier influence of Indic culture on China, but nonetheless clearly identifiable and many-hued. Acknowledging this cultural transmission from China and exploring it is, in my view, important both to have a balanced perspective on India-China historical interactions and also to enrich our understanding of the development of Indian art and craftsmanship in the modern era. Before coming to the main focus of today's presentation, which is on actually what these influences were, I would like to very briefly talk about the context in which this transmission of cultural objects and cultural influences from China to India took place in the 19th century. Some of this would be familiar to many of you. As is well known, for centuries China had been renowned for her products, particularly silk, porcelain, tea, etc., which were exported to different corners of the world. From the 17th and 18th centuries, the growing tea trade with Europe and especially Britain greatly expanded the volume of China's external trade and added immensely to its attraction for a host of traders from around the world. These ranged from powerful commercial monopolies like the British and Dutch East India Companies to small private traders. Products from India, such as raw cotton and opium, played an important role in paying for the exports of China's tea to the West. Moreover, Indian traders, stocks of cotton piled up in Bombay as well as in Bihar, opium warehouse. Indian traders and particular Parsi traders from the west coast of India acted as a major conduit of this trade, particularly from the last quarter of the 18th century. Here is a picture of probably the best known Parsi trader from India, Jamsetji Jijibhoy, who operated mainly from Bombay but did make several voyages to China in his early years. And you know, it's a painting of him by a Chinese painter with a Chinese secretary there. Hundreds of Parsi traders made their way to the southern coast of China on huge sailing ships, undeterred by the many perils of the voyage, including typhoons, pirates, and shipwrecks. It is a fact, though one rarely acknowledged in the voluminous Western literature on the old China trade from Canton, that Parsis at Canton or Guangzhou often outnumbered their British and other Western counterparts in the early decades of the 19th century. The world of the foreign traders at Canton, which was centered, as you all know, on the area known as that of the 13 factories on the Canton waterfront, was designed to provide for all the residential as well as the commercial needs of the foreign traders. Out of the cloistered world of the 13 factories and located within it, emerged a flourishing industry of export art, which encompassed items as varied as watercolors and oil paintings, jade items, porcelain, silk, silk embroidery, furniture, enamel, lacquerware, and silver. The trade in art objects was never the main stuff of the China trade, but there was nevertheless a lively demand for the products of Chinese artists and craftsmen. The production of these cultural items for export, in fact, achieved a level of organization and efficiency that paralleled the trade in tea and other commodities. And a large number of workshops sprang up in Guangzhou for the purpose of producing this export art. Parsi and other Indian traders at Canton, with a few notable exceptions, like Jamsetji Jijibhoy, were mostly small-time traders operating on the margins of the legal trade. They constantly faced the problem of finding suitable commodities to ship back home after they had unloaded their opium, raw cotton, and other items of import. In theory, all foreign traders had to purchase their goods they needed from the licensed Chinese merchants and compradors. In reality, many of the smaller traders found it more convenient and cheaper to deal directly with the unlicensed merchants, who are also known as outside merchants or shopmen. These Chinese merchants maintained their shops in the crowded by-lanes in between and just behind the factories, where the export art workshops were also located. Well, this is a picture of a street called Old China Street, which was one of those lanes, along with New China Street, Hog Lane, and all, which divided the factories in the waterfront, that area. Among the early art items purchased by Indian traders were porcelain vases, plates, and other objects. Chinese porcelain items, besides being appreciated for their beauty, were a useful form of ballast. They were regularly shipped back home to adorn the sumptuous homes of the wealthy in Bombay, where they can still be found. Paintings, furniture, and pearls and other form of jewelry were also shipped home, both as commodities to sell and as gifts for family members and friends. In many respects, Indian traders followed the tastes of their European counterparts in their choice of art items to take from China back to India. However, in certain respects, particularly in their appreciation of Chinese silk and embroidery, their choices were clearly influenced more by Indian aesthetic values and the requirements of Indian clothing. By focusing on the kind of art and cultural products that were imported into India from China, and then examining how these influenced Indian traditions and Indian workmanship, we can expand the extensive discussion that already exists on the subject of Chinese export art. Chinese export art has been recognized as a distinct genre of art emerging from about the 17th century that catered to foreign consumers. But the discussion has almost always been centered on the production of art for the European and American markets. Nevertheless, we can see that Chinese export art was also produced with the Indian consumer in mind. Chinese artistic techniques and motifs were adapted to Indian tastes and requirements to produce unique examples of Sino-Indian cultural fusion. Now, I'll turn to two examples to illustrate what I'm saying, and one is reverse glass painting, and the other concerns textiles, especially silk weaving and silk embroidery. Now, reverse glass painting actually originated in Central and Eastern Europe from where it came to China, although the manner and timing of its introduction into China is disputed. Nevertheless, by the 18th century, glass painting was a well-established tradition in China, centered in Canton. It was not much esteemed as art by the Chinese themselves, but was in great demand among foreign buyers. Since the painting was done on the reverse side of a sheet of glass and then given a wooden backing, it could be sold soon after completion without having to wait for the painting to dry. For the seller, this meant more rapid sales, while for the purchaser, glass paintings were cheaper than oils, and the glass protection meant that the painting could be kept clean and free of scratches. Initially, glass paintings were produced in the Canton workshops and imported into India. However, glass paintings also came to be painted by Chinese artists who were brought to India for the purpose. Portraits were particularly favored by status-conscious Bombay merchants, who commissioned these Chinese artists to paint them and their families. It is interesting that the demand for this new and unusual form of painting was not confined only to those with the China trade, connected with the China trade. It also became popular among the royalty and elite of the various princely states of India, who became major patrons of artists and craftsmen, including foreign artists, particularly following the decline of the Mughal court. Chinese painters are known to have been in residence at the courts of the ruler of Satara, which is in present-day Maharashtra, Kutch, which is in present-day Gujarat, and Mysore, which is in Karnataka. Apart from the portraits of the rulers and the nobility, idealized portraits of courtesans, dancers, and other beautiful women were also favored. More than 40 paintings done by Chinese artists under the patronage of the ruler of Mysore, Tipu Sultan, are lodged in the Jagan Mohan Palace Art Gallery in Mysore. Portraits of Indian gods and goddesses and themes from Indian mythology were also done by Chinese artists. This is interesting because even today you find quite a lot of Ganeshas and other Indian things, gods and gods, icons being done by Chinese artists. Even though the lack of feeling of the Chinese painters for their subject in this case is sometimes noticeable, I'd like to show you two slides. Now, this is a Chinese reverse glass painting of an Indian girl, and you can see from the features that there is a Chinese, clear Chinese look. You won't find this much in among Indian. And then there's this one. Now, this is supposed to be a painting of, Chinese painting of Shiva, the Indian god Shiva with a beard. Again, you can notice, you know, the features. It's very different from the Shiva you'll find in India. And even the clothing worn by Shiva is rarely, the top part would not be like this. So there is some, there's an attempt to portray Shiva, like the trident which he's holding in is clearly an Hindu symbol, and you have the mountains, he's always associated with the mountains and all that. But something is very different here. So, you know, these are, you know, two examples. And just for a well, I'll show you a little later, a comparison with an Indian painting. Now, the popularity of glass painting, a completely new form of art in India, is an example of the broadening of aesthetic tastes among Indians on account of exposure to foreign cultural traditions and art forms through trade. The technique of glass painting was adopted by Indian craftsmen and spread widely through India, as far as Tanjore in the south, Hyderabad and the Deccan region, and in the north, Delhi, Awadh, Bihar and East Bengal. Now, this is a really classic example of a Tanjore glass painting, which they are very famous now in India. And you can see the difference in the features and the portrayal of things. But the technique of glass painting was from China. The adoption of religious themes and its relatively inexpensive nature led to this particular art form becoming a form of popular art that appealed not just to the upper and middle classes, but also to a broader section of the population. The noted artist and art historian Jaya Appasamy has commented that, and I quote, although the technique was adopted from foreign sources, it became the vehicle of a popular art in India. And again, I quote, it was used to produce, she says that it was used to produce Indian pictures for an Indian audience. Coming to the other example I mentioned, that is of textiles. The influence of Indian traditions on Indian traditions of artistic forms transmitted from China is perhaps even better exemplified in the case of silk embroidery and silk weaving. This is not surprising. For many centuries, there had been a flourishing intra-Asian trade in textiles, and different Asian textile traditions had over a long period of time considerably influenced each other, even while retaining their own uniqueness. Both Chinese and Indian textiles traditionally were embellished with a considerable amount of embroidery. Western India had a particularly rich tradition of embroidery, so it is perhaps no wonder that Chinese silk embroidery particularly attracted the attention of Parsi and other traders from Bombay. From their fascination with Chinese embroidery developed the beautiful Gara sari. Sari, of course, is the Indian women's wear. And this type of sari is known as the Gara sari. The Parsi women wear this on a, nowadays only for import occasions. This is a heavily embroidered thick silk sari, much prized by Parsi women and worn on important occasions such as weddings. On their arrival in China for the trading season, Parsi merchants would place orders for embroidered lengths of cloth to be made into saris and also into sari blouses and borders, children's jackets and edging for trousers. Traditional Chinese hand embroidery required very fine detailed work involving painstaking labor. Nevertheless, it was possible for Chinese craftsmen to produce the finished products on time before the Parsi merchants set sail for home at the end of the trading season because of the practice of several artisans working together simultaneously on a particular piece in the workshop set up for this purpose. Gara embroidery in white or light colored threads was usually done on a dark background of red, purple, or black silk, using a very fine satin stitch, which in India was known as the khaka stitch, which gave them an impression of the cloth being covered with tiny seed pearls. The work would sometimes be done only on the borders or the pallu of the sari. The pallu is the part which would be draped over the arm and the shoulder. In the more elaborate garas, like this one, the entire field would be covered with embroidery. This was done so neatly that it often gave the impression of the sari being painted or woven rather than embroidered. A variety of typically Chinese motifs can be found on the garas, which you can see here. These included flowers, representatives of the seasons, such as peonies, plum blossoms, chrysanthemums, and lotuses. Also very common were bamboo, pomegranates, peaches, and animals and birds of all descriptions, such as the pheasant, wild geese, and the crane, you can see here. In some typical scenes of Chinese life, including representations of Chinese men and women, pagodas and pavilions were also worked in. The embroiderers also at times used symbols from Chinese mythology, such as the eight immortals, heavenly fungus, and the dragon. But the gara came to represent not a direct import of a Chinese cultural tradition, but its skillful adaptation to Indian requirements and tastes. For instance, to suit the preference of Parsi women, the larger Chinese motifs, such as the dragon, were gradually discarded in favor of flowers, birds, and other similar motifs. The typical Indian symbol of the peacock was mastered by the Chinese craftsmen, as was the Indian ambi, or the paisley motif. Yet another example of adaptation was what came to be known as the dopatti or dopat saris in India. These were made by stitching a regular length of Chinese silk to another length of half the width, since Chinese looms, being narrower than Indian looms, could not produce the required width for Indian saris. So here's again a case of the artists, craftsmen adapting to the Indian taste. Due to the popularity of Chinese embroidery, Chinese embroiderers were brought to Surat, which is another town on the port town on the west coast of India, and other towns to practice their art. They gave rise to a tradition of embroidery known in India appropriately as Chennai. Even as late as the early 20th century, Chinese peddlers could be found on the streets of Bombay, going from house to house, displaying their highly prized embroidered silks and cottons. However, it was not long before garas, on the same lines as those from China, began to be copied and produced in India by Indian embroiderers. As we know from various references in Indian works, early Indian works, Chinese silk too has been known and prized in India from ancient times. Bolts of Chinese silk were imported into India as part of the 19th century China trade as well. A byproduct of this was the birth and development of the art of tanchoi silk weaving in China. You know, most people in India who wear silk saris will know of tanchoi silk. But in fact, tanchoi silk is well known in India and usually identified with the famous weaving centers of Varanasi. But the art of tanchoi weaving, in fact, arrived in India from China via the West Coast. Jamsachi Jiji Boy, the Parsi trader whom I had shown earlier, is said to have been responsible for sending Indian weavers to China to learn the art of producing the fine satin brocade for which China was famous. As the story goes, three brothers from the Joshi family of Surat went to Shanghai to learn the art from a master weaver whose name has come down to us as Choi. The material they produced after they returned to India came to be known as Tanchoi. The Tanchoi is usually a dark satin weave of purple, red, blue, or green. Floral patterns interspersed with birds and creepers are woven into the entire body. As in the case of the gara sari we described earlier, the motifs are recognizably Chinese in inspiration. These are not very typical of Indian designs. However, Indian weavers gradually introduced typically Indian motifs such as the mango or the ambi, as it was called. So here's a sign of, this is the mango motif on the border of a sari. Although the Joshi family in Surat continued to produce the tanchoi saris well into the 20th century, the headquarters of tanchoi weaving in India shifted to Varanasi after its skilled silk weavers learned the art and succeeded in producing it at a lower cost. Today, Tanchoi silk weaving has been indigenized to such an extent that few are aware of its Chinese origins and inspiration. So, in conclusion, we can see that cultural interaction between India and China, which began around 2000 years ago, continued to flourish in the early modern era, although perhaps on a less dramatic and inspired scale than during the Buddhist era. The process of cultural diffusion from China to India in the 19th century took place through the most unlikely medium of a trade that was dominated by the sale of Indian raw cotton and opium in China. The cold calculation of profit involved in this trade perhaps contrasts strangely with the genuine appreciation of artistic skill represented not only by the import of Chinese cultural objects, but also by the invitations extended to Chinese artists and craftsmen to practice their skills in India. However, trade and exchange of cultural influences between different societies have always gone hand in hand and should not be seen as mutually exclusive phenomena. This was especially true among Asian societies where, particularly in the case of the traditional trade in textiles, both the economic and the cultural impact was significant. It is no surprise that the trade in Guangzhou in the early modern era, which knitted together several diverse and far-flung regions of the world, should have served as a transmitter of material culture and have influenced lifestyles and tastes across several countries. The production of Chinese export art at Guangzhou was an astounding phenomenon in the way that it was organized and streamlined to meet the demands of a steadily widening class of consumers around the globe with a taste for the new and the exotic. But the identification of Chinese export art solely with the Western market is not justifiable, as it does not take into account the fact that it also catered to the Indian market. As we have seen, the Indian demand for Chinese art in this period did not merely ape Western fashions, but also emerged from Indian tastes and values. The export art workshops at Guangzhou became experts at producing designs and textures and artwork favored by Indian customers, just as they did for Western customers. Finally, in the examples we have highlighted in this paper, we can distinguish various stages in the process of cultural transmission from China to India through this trade. One is the importation by Indian merchants of cultural products made in China by Chinese artists and craftsmen. In the next stage, we have cultural products being made by Chinese artists and craftsmen, but in India and catering exclusively to Indian consumers. We have the adaptation of skills, designs, and motifs derived from China to suit Indian aesthetic values and cultural preferences. This can be seen in the adaptation of embroidery to suit Indian saris and clothing, in the adoption of typically Indian motifs such as the mango and the peacock, and in the case of glass painting, the adoption of Indian religious themes. This kind of adaptation enabled Chinese cultural influences to penetrate more widely and deeply into Indian society. They were not confined only to the elite or those who had direct contact with the China trade, but spread among the elite in other parts of India and the wider public as well. Finally, we have the Chinese art forms being studied and mastered by Indian artists and craftsmen in India, and then further developed by them in accordance with their own genius. The Tanchoi silk weaving carried out in Varanasi and the different schools of glass painting that developed in India from the 19th century represent this kind of import substitution, to borrow a contemporary formulation. Ultimately, we can argue that this process resulted in altogether new and hybrid forms of art and crafts in India, which, while they were undoubtedly Chinese in origin and inspiration, nevertheless have become an intrinsic part of the Indian cultural tradition. Thank you. I'll stop there.